It's the Philosopher's Zone on RN. Joe Gelonesi with you. Great to have your company. Today, maths, morals, and the material world.
Some of the ancient Greek philosophers, especially Plato and Aristotle, were always pointing to our ability to get beyond the here and now, a world of truths beyond reality, but in some sense about reality. And mathematics is exhibit A for these people, because mathematics seems to be the kind of thing you can just get truths by sitting in the armchair and thinking purely. Nevertheless, it's not just our thoughts. It works perfectly well in the real world.
Maths is not my strong suit, so I envy those who can juggle a number or two, like James Franklin, good with maths and good with philosophy. James is trying to break an ancient impasse between those who believe that maths is made up and those who see it connect to universal truths. He's sort of in the latter camp, but with a twist, and his third way touches on the curious crossover of maths and morality, which is where we'll start. The parallel between ethics and mathematics. On first viewing, there doesn't seem to be a connection. You've actually argued there is.
Yes, I think there is a close parallel between ethics and mathematics, or mathematics and morals. And they're both, at first glance, you think you have a conscience that's something like a mathematical insight. You think you can understand objectively what is right and wrong. And that in some way that's in the armchair as well, like mathematics. It's no point going out measuring people to determine who's of greater value than other people. It's an intuition you have that people are of the same value, and hence that, for example, if a general has to decide on two strategies, and their only real difference is the amount of casualties, the fact that people have equal worth means that he ought to choose the one with the least casualties. Now, that's it's not empirical, it's like mathematics, and in fact it depends on one of the basic mathematical concepts, equality.
Mm. So draw out for me this parallel. How does that parallel exist? Is it because you're saying that there is an intuition about mathematical axioms and what might be true in the world of maths, and what we understand to be the right things to do in the world of ethics?
That's exactly right, yes. And we very much feel ourselves to have those kind of intuitions and insights in both areas. And you would need quite a strong argument to say that those are not the case. Of course, there are people who have tried to make that argument, such as Peter Singer, Australia's most famous philosopher. He does say that there is, on the surface, a parallel between our intuition in mathematics and in ethics. But he hopes to undermine that by going for a philosophy of mathematics that he says undermines the idea that we have intuition in mathematics. And he goes for the philosophy of mathematics called logicism, invented 100 years ago or so by Gottlob Frege and Bertrand Russell, according to which mathematics is not contentful. It's not really about anything. It's just a series of logical truths like X is X, but dressed up in very complex ways that take a while to work through. Singer, in fact, says that this philosophy of mathematics is believed by almost all philosophers of mathematics, and this shows that intuition is undermined in mathematics, and hence there's no reason to take it seriously in ethics either.
This is quite an important argument for him to win, really.
That's right. He very much needs to win the argument in the philosophy of mathematics, taking his parallel. And he can't win it because his history is wrong. Hardly any philosophers of mathematics in the last 100 years have agreed with logicism because it didn't work out. And Bertrand Russell admitted that it didn't work out. There are very many technical reasons, but a simple way to see what went wrong is to think about the fact that the numbers don't run out, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, etc. There's no highest number, but it's impossible to reduce that to logic. It's not a matter of logic, and it's not a matter of what we made up either. Numbers are not made up by us. They're the way things must be counted.
Let's just go through that. They're not made up by us. They're the way things must be counted. But the argument against that in the Singerian universe is that, in fact, we've just really made that up. It's just a tautology. We've just said that there is 1 plus 1 and that equals 2, and from there we build upon those sets of tautologies.
You could define 2 to be 1 plus 1, but by the time you get a bit more, do you define 4 to be 2 plus 2 or 1 plus 3? Well, if you're going to have tautologies, it can't be both. It's a mathematical fact that 2 plus 2 equals 1 plus 3. And as things get more complicated, they become less purely logical. Mm. And it's especially the fact that there's no stopping to the numbers. You can't define that to be the case. there may be a finite number of electrons in the universe, but that doesn't mean that the numbers themselves run out. There could be more electrons. There's more and more electrons breeding. You're not going to run out of numbers to count them with.
To actually attach to them to count them. This is very interesting. You use the term equality, the equality in mathematics and equality as a concept in ethics as well. Can you just explain to me how you use that term and why that creates a parallel, or at least can put forward an argument of parallelism between the two?
Well, equality just means what it says. Things are equal normally in some respects. So electrons, for example, are equal in their charge. And according to our basic ethical intuitions, humans are equal in their moral worth. And it's a little hard to say on what basis that is. What is it about humans that mean they've got more moral worth than, say, cats? But nevertheless, we have a very strong intuition that your worth is as much as my worth. So universalizability in Kant's language comes from that, and that means that the child of, say, seven has a very strong sense that something or other is not fair to me. The other child has got an ice cream, I haven't got an ice cream. It's not fair. But we understand that fairness is symmetrical, and that if it's something that's not fair to me, it must be for some reason, because I deserve it, but some other person in the same circumstances would deserve the same thing.
Mm. Just going back to this question of the equality, or should I say the parallel between the ethical world and, say, the world of maths, that why couldn't they just be distinct anyway, that there might be a full objective reality in the world of maths, but in fact there is a historical, contextual, and highly human-constructed world in the world of ethics? Why do the two need to necessarily be proved or disproved in a parallel fashion?
They could turn out to be different, and of course there are certain culturally constructed things in ethics, and indeed, there are in mathematics, for example, mathematical notation. It's just the way it is. But nevertheless, the suggestion is that when you look carefully and strip away all that, you're going to find in both cases that there is a strong intuition that you can't get behind, and that there's no way to construct ethics differently to make the tribe over the hill worth nothing so that you can massacre them.
James Franklin on the link between morals and maths should get the dinner party going. It's connected to his latest work, which attempts a peace deal for an old stoush. Is mathematics purely a human invention, or does it point to something more substantial about the real nature of everything? As we'll hear, his remedy is a little bit Plato and a lot more Aristotle. You say that maths has always been exhibit A for rationalists, who say that we have a way into the reality of the universe beyond what comes to our senses. What did you mean by that?
Yes, one of the big themes in philosophy is the dispute between empiricists or naturalists on the one hand and rationalists on the other. So naturalists think that everything in the universe is pretty much as you get out of bed and see it. It's just material things and we're just animals. The picture is just as science shows it. But rationalists, on the other hand, think there's something more to that. Somewhere at the back of the universe, there's necessities, the way things must be, and perhaps mathematics, ethics, and areas like that. And furthermore, that the human consciousness, intelligence, has a way directly into that. Some of the ancient Greek philosophers, especially Plato and Aristotle, were always pointing to our ability to get beyond the here and now, the contingent, what just happens to be in the here and now, and get into a world of truths, of necessities, absolute truths, beyond reality, but in some sense about reality. And mathematics, as you were saying, is exhibit A for these people, because mathematics seems to be the kind of thing you can just get truths by sitting in the armchair and thinking purely. It's not that you have to get into the lab coat and go out and measure things. Mathematics is something that you do by pure thought. Nevertheless, it's not just our thoughts. It works perfectly well in the real world. There's a old saying, the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics in the natural sciences. In physics, in every other natural science, mathematics tells you something about how things really are.
Mm. If you take that line, that has caused a problem for the empirical sciences. Has science attempted to naturalize mathematics in any ways? Has it attempted to say that, well, in fact, it's not something out there that you can do from your armchair? It is actually very much part of the empirical way of looking at things.
People who think along those lines have gone for a nominalist theory of mathematics, which is deconstructive or represents it as not really about anything and just our ways of thinking or our forms of understanding or our language. It's very easy if you come from mathematics at school to think that it's just about moving formulas around. As a mathematician and mathematics educator, I have to apologise maybe for the degree to which mathematics education is about just pushing around formulas. And you can get the impression that it's either trivial truths, just saying this x equals x in complicated ways, or it's just moving around uninterpreted symbols like a computer does. But it's not like that. Applied mathematics really does tell you about the real world. For example, the way that our weather prediction works, it's about mathematical models, and the mathematics, working through the mathematics, allows you to predict what is actually going to happen out there.
Okay, now back to the question of Platonism and nominalism. This necessity doesn't have to be in another world, the way that perhaps Plato had suggested, an abstract world of things which aren't, which we can infer or we can have some intuition of. This is not the way the Aristotelian realist method would look at it.
That's right. Aristotelian realism contrasts with Platonist realism. One of the long-running philosophies of mathematics that's realist is Platonist or Platonic realism. According to that, and it's very easy to think this way, numbers or sets and the things that mathematics talks about are not in this world but in some other realm beyond sense experience. So you think, for example, that how many numbers are there between 10 and 20? There's a fixed number there, and you could, there's a, so to speak, topography out there. You can go out and count them, and that's how it must be. You can think that that's beyond this world, but the Aristotelian realism that I'm in favour of says that those necessities can actually be found in this world. And I believe that example I took of 2 multiplied by 3 as 3 multiplied by 2 illustrates that. It's not in a world beyond reality. It's actually something that can be perceived to be necessarily true in the things right before you.
What are the objections to that? I mean, would the size of something, the fact that you can't, that some structures are too big to realise, is that an objection?
That is a substantial objection. So what to say about things beyond what you can think of on what in fact exists? So what about infinities, for example? It could be, though we don't know the truth of this, that there are only a finite number of things in the universe. It could be that the universe is a certain size across and there's a fixed number of electrons. So what do you say about the truths of mathematical truths about infinite numbers? Well, the Aristotelian says that though they don't happen to be realised in reality, they could be. If reality grew, then there's only one way they could be realised. So Aristotelian realism says that you can get to truths by perception, by intuiting on perception, but nevertheless, the mind has an ability to go beyond perception to what is not in fact in perception, but could be. So I think a nice parallel is Hume's example of an uninstantiated shade of blue. Hume says that what if there's a very fine shade of blue that actually you've never seen and isn't in anything? He says nevertheless you can have knowledge of that because you can, the mind is able to fill in between the experiences it's had and realise that colour in fact varies continuously and that there is in fact a gap here, and you can have, the science of colour should tell you about uninstantiated shades of colour as well as ones that have actually been observed.
That dangerously, though, gets close to the other objection that in fact it's still a form of idealisation, that it isn't, not instantiated, it's not in the real world.
It is in the real world sometimes, and when it is, you can see it there. When it isn't, you can still get truths about it because the intellect, well, that's the good thing about the intellect, and that again is why, one of the reasons why mathematics is exhibit A for the rationalist side. The rationalists say that there's something unique about human consciousness and intelligence, that it can not only find things about this world, but find things about other possible worlds. There's a saying that imagination is mental time travel, and it's very useful to be able to work out not only what happens in this world, but what happens in another world that you might come across or might be able to build. That's design.
So this question of intuition is interesting because what you're talking about now, this Aristotelian realist version of mathematics, that's not based on intuition. That's based on the real world and noticing mathematics in the real world.
It's based on noticing mathematics, but when you look into the mathematics, you find necessities there. Let me give a simple example. Imagine a row of three dots, horizontal dots, and below them another row of three horizontal dots. So that's two rows of three dots, one above the other. That's 2 multiplied by 3, and there's 6 dots. Now change your imagination to imagining the same 6 dots as 3 columns of 2. So that's 3 multiplied by 2. So you can see that because the 6 is 2 multiplied by 3 and also 3 multiplied by 2, you've perceived that that's how things must be. It's not a logical truth, but it's a truth about reality. It's about those real 6 dots, or 6 imagined dots, but they could be real ones. And at the same time, it's necessarily true, and your intuition, or you might even say internal perception, has got you in touch with the necessities behind perception, the necessities behind empirical reality.
Mm. It's a hard one, isn't it? The two things are meeting there. You're saying that there is a necessity, but your mind is coming to that necessity through experience.
That's right. The experience triggers the necessity, but it's something extra. We think that animals can't do that. Animals can perhaps count a little bit and they can see things, but we think they don't have that intellectual perception of necessity, as far as we know.
He hasn't met my cat. James Franklin on Real Mathematics for the Real World, as a way of calling a truce in the maths war. In this 400th anniversary year of the logarithm, we're giving mathematics a workout here on the Philosopher's Zone.
The sum of the square roots of any two sides of an isosceles triangle is equal to the square root of the remaining side.
That's a right triangle, you idiot!
Let X equal X.
Homer Simpson, dealing with some pretty big data. His creators often ran maths gags in the background of Simpson's episodes, including trying to solve Fermat's Last Theorem. Not sure, though, where they fall in this question of maths in the real world, what James Franklin calls Aristotelian realism. You use an example of trying to imagine a prehistoric time, dinosaur time, as a way of coming to terms with these internal relationships. Can you tell me a little bit about that? Because yeah, that
little,
seems to work well.
A scenario, I think, that shows what the Aristotelian philosophy of mathematics is on about, as opposed to Platonist and nominalist ones. So think about the world before there were humans, let's say the world of the dinosaurs. So there's no humans doing mathematics, no formulas, and no abstract entities like numbers either. There's just, well, there's dinosaurs of different size, big ones, little ones, brontosauruses. There's trees, volcanoes, flowing rivers, that kind of thing, a few clumps of plants. Now let's ask ourselves, what in that world is of a mathematical nature? Well, for example, there's symmetries. The dinosaurs have an approximate bilateral symmetry like all the higher animals. There's also symmetry of a kind in the volcanoes and trees. If you look at them from the top down, they're approximately circularly symmetrical. That is the same in all directions from their axis. There's flows, the river flows, but perhaps most basically there's ratios. So the brontosaurus is a lumbering animal, but there's agile little dinosaurs. Now, why is a brontosaurus like an elephant lumbering? Well, it's because when you scale animals up, volume and hence mass scales a lot more than the linear dimensions, like the size of the legs. So that for the size of the legs, a brontosaurus has an enormous amount more weight to carry than the little agile ones, so they can get away.
It's a good way to do it, although the objection to you would be, this is your mind constructing it, so somehow or other it has to be filtered through the perceptions and through everything else. You can't have a place where it's mind unadorned.
Your knowledge of it, of course, if you were there, your knowledge of it would be through your mind, but that's just because knowledge is all through the mind. That's true of your knowledge of the dinosaur colours as well. But nevertheless, the shapes, for example, themselves are not constructed by your mind. They're out there and perceived by you. And the symmetry ratio and so on are there prior, like any other real properties of the world. They're there ready for you to perceive. Mm. So if you and I stand beside each other, it's easily perceived the approximate ratio of your height to mine. That's out there. It's locked in once our lengths are there, once our heights are there. Nothing constructed about that.
So they have fought this battle to a standstill, the Platonists have not won, the nominalists have not won?
That's right. The Platonists and nominalists who've occupied most of the room in philosophy and mathematics have fought each other to a standstill and shown the mistakes of the other side, but they haven't established their own side, and I believe that's why it's time for a new direction in the Aristotelian philosophy of mathematics that tells you that there are necessities that you can understand, but they're in this world, or could be.
This cuts to the core of pure versus applied mathematics, and you talked about that before in the classroom. You teach, you've been very much involved in the education of mathematics for many, many, many years. What do students understand of maths, do you think?
They do tend, especially coming from our school education system, to think of it as a grab bag of formulas. And they're supported in that by perhaps engineers who think of mathematics as a pile of formulas that you pull off the shelf or out of the software and use to get real results, a kind of theoretical juice extractor, as some philosopher called it, as opposed to mathematics being something that is about the real world itself. So that means that applied mathematics takes, unfortunately, a low rank often in the education of mathematics, so that it's very easy to leave mathematics at an earlier stage when you've learnt too many methods and formulas and think, that's great, I've had another day where I haven't had to use my algebraic formulas. But that's not really what mathematics is about. The real mathematics should start with applied mathematics and then go later to the pure mathematical methods that are helpful for that. There's a interesting book introducing applied maths or mathematical modelling called Towing Icebergs and Falling Dominoes. And the example of towing icebergs is a good one. The question is, how should you work out if it's worthwhile to, for example, bring an iceberg from Antarctica and park it beside Adelaide and solve the water shortage there? Now, there are a few basic facts, physical facts you need, like how far Adelaide is from the Antarctic and how long it would take an iceberg to get there and the fuel and so on. But really, the essence of the problem is to put together all the quantitative facts of those kinds and work out if, all things considered, after you've spent the fuel and taken the time, have you got enough water there to make some impact on Adelaide's annual consumption? So that's, I think, real applied mathematics. Mm. It's a problem where you have to put together a whole lot of quantitative information and structure and reach a conclusion. Not too many formulas in it, though some basic ones will be necessary.
Mm. And this is what you call about it's time to get back to things in themselves.
Yes, old philosophy saying back to the things themselves, and I think we need that in mathematics education as well, to demonstrate that mathematics is really telling you something about the mathematical aspects of the world, the quantitative aspects, ratios, symmetries, structures, that kind of thing.
It's the relationships, isn't it?
It's relationships, but it might be better to say internal relationships. So we have a vast amount of data now. We need to look at the structure that the data shows to work out how to solve a problem, say fraud detection. So fraud detection is a very mathematically high-powered method used on data. What you have a large amount of data, and the problem in fraud detection is to work out where to put your investigative effort next. So what you want to look for is unusual data. So what does unusual mean? Well, it means data, well, that's what you have to think of. What is structurally about this data? Is 37 people at the same post office box getting a pension? Is this suspicious? Yeah, because there's something unusual about it. It's an outlier, different from the data in some quantitative sense.
Mm. It seems to me the key term is the realism part of the Aristotelianism, realism. And I think this has been put to you before, but this is a particularly Australian way of looking at the world. We just recently spoke about the death of David Armstrong, for instance.
Yes, David Armstrong put back on the world agenda in metaphysics an Australian realism that took very seriously the realism of the properties of things, colours, shapes, sizes, ratios and so on. I think I would say that my book on Aristotelian realism in the philosophy of mathematics is something like the book he would have written if he'd been interested in mathematics.
James Franklin, thank you for being in the Philosopher's Zone. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you.
James Franklin from the University of New South Wales. And his latest book is titled An Aristotelian Realist Philosophy of Mathematics. You'll have a view, no doubt, and you're welcome to make it. Just go to our comments page online. You can also hear the program again or take it away for later. Next week, we begin our summer season, starting with that curious look at insects from earlier in the year, small, creaturely, and thoroughly disorienting. Hope you can join us then and all through the summer season. On behalf of the team, Diane Dean and Charles McCune, I'm Joe Gelonesi. See you again in the Zone.